Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. With fall upon us, I don't have to remind you that it's football season. And in spite of the COVID-19 pandemic, teams at all levels, from the NFL to our local high schools, are playing the gladiatorial strategic game, albeit with precautions, postponements, deferrals, and sometimes even outright cancellations. In a rational world, we'd probably not play football this year, but football is the most popular of American sports. And as my guest today suggests, it's a way of life, a culture unto itself, an expression of American values. Some might even go so far as to say a religion. Journalist Reed Forgrave is a reporter with the Star Tribune of Minneapolis, where he does long-form reporting on regional stories in the upper Midwest. He's previously reported for outlets like CBS Sports, Fox Sports, and did a prior stint at the Des Moines Register in Iowa. He's also written for national magazines like GQ and the New York Times Magazine. His new book is called Love, Zach: Small Town Football and the Life and Death of an American Boy. It's an examination of the culture and family life of the Easters of Indianola, Iowa, and the tragic loss of their son Zach to chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE, at the shockingly young age of 24 when he took his own life. Journalist Reed Forgrave is our guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Reed Forgrave, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by having you just tell us, basically, who was Zach Easter?
Zach Easter was a 24-year-old man from small-town Iowa. He grew up in the cornfields and timber outside a small town called Indianola, Iowa, which is not that far from Des Moines. And he was from a very, traditional rural Midwestern America family. They've been on this land for seven generations. His family goes back to Iowa since before the Civil War, much of that on the same plot of land. And they very much grew up working the land. And that became a huge part of how they saw masculinity. And by the time Zach came around, masculinity in this family was defined through playing football. And Zach was the middle of three brothers. He played football from third grade through high school, fearlessly, some would say recklessly. He suffered many concussions, at least six documented concussions, and likely many more. And after high school, really started to go downhill, starting to have all sorts of issues, memory issues, what he referred to as brain tremors, migraines, slurred speech, blurred vision. And Zach thought, this is CTE. He was reading up on chronic traumatic encephalopathy, this insidious brain disease that has affected so many athletes in contact sports, but especially in football. And in December 2015, Zach took his own life. And it's obviously a tragedy, but the blessing behind this tragedy is that Zach left behind journals, he left behind writings, and he left behind very explicit instructions to his parents, to his family, to his girlfriend, to share his story. And I think what made this book possible is the fact, one, that there's this very real sense of Zach speaking to you from beyond the grave. And two, just the fact that his family, despite there being some incredibly dark and some incredibly embarrassing moments in Zach's writing and in this book, they want to tell that story. They don't want to tell it because they're like, we think football needs to go away. They want football to be safer, and they want parents, by the way, parents like myself, I have two young boys, they want parents to look at football and say, we need to go into this with eyes wide open and realize, yes, there are obviously rewards to football. It is America's favorite sport for a reason, but there are very real risks to the sport, and parents very much need to be aware of that.
Yeah, so put us into a little bit of context. How popular is football by numbers, if you know them? I mean, we always talk about baseball as America's national pastime, but baseball really hasn't been the most popular sport in America for quite some time.
Yeah, it hasn't. I pinpointed one moment in this book where I think that football officially overtook baseball as the sport of America. I know we don't call it America's pastime because football's not a pastime. It's a lifestyle. It's so much more than just a way to pass the time. Football it's enormous. If you look at just the NFL, their revenue is more than $15 billion a year, more than any sports league in the entire world. There's this fantasy football is, of all the fantasy sports, that is by far the most popular. It seems like a silly game, and then you get involved in it, and you realize there are hundreds of millions of people out there playing fantasy football. My little sister, who knows absolutely nothing about football, she'll join fantasy football leagues. And I think I did a lot in this book. This book is that story. But I also tried to expand it into bigger things, the culture of football, the history of football. And one of the most fascinating things to me in researching this book is how the rise of football, how it became America's most popular sport, very much mirrors the rise of America as a superpower, as a global superpower. Football starts shortly after the Civil War, as we are, you know, picking up all the ashes from this awful war. It were becoming a more industrialized country. We don't have war to prove our manhood during, you know, the late 1800s. So in many ways, that's transferred to the football field. You hear people like Teddy Roosevelt speaking of football in the early 1900s. He brought together all the college presidents, and I think it was 1905, had a convention at the White House that was basically a we must save football convention. And it was because 30-some people had died playing football just that year. And Teddy Roosevelt says, I love football. I believe football is part of how we create the strong American character. But guys, you got to clean it up. Out of that meeting comes the NCAA. That's how the NCAA was created. It's fascinating to me just how vital this sport is to our vision of ourselves as a strong, powerful country, how tied in it is with the military, and also how tied in it is with corporate America. It's not just you see planes fly over NFL stadiums and you see all these corporate sponsorships. The ties between football, the military, and creating corporate and military leaders goes back more than a century.
Yeah, the Teddy Roosevelt's famous quote I think you have in there about the sweat or dirt of the gladiator in the arena, the man in the arena. But I was really interested in that history just because I, you know, I've more or less followed football, kind of grew up rooting for the hapless Cleveland Browns. But I didn't know that so many people had died early on, that it had an existential crisis, you know, way back before World War One. And that was really educational part about your book. But so Zach Easter, you told us that he started football in third grade. When did the full contact start?
Yeah, in third grade. And by the way, a quick aside, I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but my friend, I somehow grew up as a fan of the hapless Cleveland Browns as well. And there's nothing more painful.
Wow.
Especially when you're growing up in Pittsburgh.
Well, yeah, I would say, growing up in Pittsburgh, you'd be an outcast for sure.
My family from small town Ohio got to me very early by giving me a brown shirt when I think I was in second grade. And, you know, it cursed me for the rest of my life. But Zach, he was playing full contact, helmet, pads, football, starting in third grade. He was playing up a year because his dad was a coach, so he was the youngest guy on that team. But he was a very talented football player. However, he was a little bit small for his age. I think if you looked at Zach, you'd see a normal-sized kid. But on the football field, the kids who excel aren't normal-sized kids. So that meant Zach really had to push his body to its limits, whether that meant taking pro hormones, which is sort of a steroid-like supplement that he was taking in high school, whether it was just working out to absolute insane amounts, or whether it was doing what every football coach wants you to do to a point, which is put your body in the line. Zach was absolutely fearless on the football field. And yeah, coaches value that stuff. That is like what you want more than anything in a football player, more than 4.4 speed. You want a guy who can fight through the pain. And I think what football players these days are told, they're told those same sort of things. We want you to sacrifice your body. We want you to fight through the pain up to a point. It's like, we want you to be fearless out there up until that very moment where you're going to do a head-on-head collision with another player. And then if you do that, you know, 15-yard penalty and you're thrown out of the game. I think that's a really difficult thing. Especially for teenage boys with all the testosterone going through their body, it's a really difficult thing for them to, a difficult line for them to walk.
Yeah. Let me reintroduce you. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann, and my guest today is journalist Reed Forgrave, who works at the Star Tribune of Minneapolis. He's a reporter there, and he's just written this new book called Love, Zach, Small Town Football and the Life and Death of an American Boy. And we're talking about young Zach Easter, who took his own life in 2015 at the age of 24. Reed, did in fact Zach wind up having chronic traumatic encephalopathy?
Dude, that's the amazing part, is Zach thought that he did, and he writes about it in his journals. And it turns out about 6 months after his death, his mom got an email, because Zach shot himself in the chest with his dad's shotgun in the chest because he wanted his brain donated to science. And his mom got an email from a man named Dr. Bennett Amalu, and you know him from the Will Smith movie Concussion. He's basically the doctor who did so much of the early work on CTE, starting with Mike Webster, the famous Pittsburgh Steelers player, who was in many ways sort of patient zero for this disease. And Bennett Amalu was part of the study of Zach's brain, and it turned out that, yes, he did have CTE in his 24-year-old brain. That's terrifying, right? It's terrifying to parents. It's terrifying to football fans. And I think it really does underscore not necessarily that football should go away. I'm still a huge football fan. I still suffer through Browns games, or, you know, I've sort of transferred my allegiances to the Minnesota Vikings, which is only a little bit better, by the way. But I still watch football. I love football. It's my favorite sport. Do I think it should go away? I don't want it to go away. But there are a lot of questions. You know, this is the science here. The research here is so new. There are a lot of unanswered questions about the long-term effects, not just of those big concussions, those bone-rattling hits, the ones that NFL films used to put out, you know, little videos about, and that ESPN used to have segments about where they say, he just got jacked up. Not necessarily those hits. Those hits you can legislate out of the game. But my biggest worry about the potential of football going away in a generation or two is, what about those subconcussive hits, the ones that you can't legislate out of the game? And science doesn't quite know exactly what is the bigger cause of CTE. Is it those big hits, or is it these subconcussive hits? But if you're an offensive lineman, you're talking 50, 60, 70 times a game, you smack heads with a guy, and that just builds up after time.
Yeah, I mean, prior to your book, I was always under the impression that CTE was a cumulative condition, you know, from accumulated trauma or accumulated hits to the head. And so we definitely have a model of this with concussion. And you, as you just pointed out, I mean, what about these subconcussive hits or the frequent? So I guess, does Zach Easter, does he change our thinking about this in terms of how early it can occur? I mean, clearly it does. If in fact, the only way to diagnose this, sadly, is after death. You know, is it an autopsy?
Yeah.
Because there's really no other test you can do. I mean, there are brain biopsies, but this would be an extreme reason to do one. So, I mean, that's got to put some kind of chilling effect. I mean, the numbers, you point this out, that the numbers of kids going into football, although still huge, have actually started to go down a little bit.
Which is shocking. I don't know. I forget the exact numbers, but and they're in the book, but I believe it's like high school football participation has gone down, I want to say, about 10% over the past decade. Is that the death of football? Probably not. It's parents being a little bit scared, I'm guessing, from what they see in the news, and probably for good reason. But if that continues, what does that look like a generation from now? Bennett Amalu, who I mentioned earlier, some scientists will criticize him because scientists are supposed to be pretty unbiased, right? Just the facts, man. Bennett Amalu has become a bit of a, a bit of an activist on this, because he was so pilloried by the football establishment when he was coming out with his early studies a decade or so ago. But what he says is kids should not be able to play full contact football until age 18. Why age 18? One reason is because, you know, that's when the brains are more fully developed. The other reason is that's the legal age of consent. You're not allowed to smoke a cigarette until age 18. people enjoy cigarettes, but we know it does damage. What Omalu says is you shouldn't be able to play football, full contact football, in helmets and pads until age 18, because football is something we enjoy, but it does damage. Not that different than cigarettes. If that happens, my guess is football goes away because it destroys the pipeline. I worry about what happens when you have these phenomenal athletes who start playing football at age 18 in a fully formed body and don't know the fundamentals of the sport. I don't think that's a very realistic solution. But when I do look at things like youth football, when I have friends here in Minneapolis who have their 8-year-old in full contact, helmet and pads, the whole shebang type football, that scares me. And I think that is something where parents really need to think, is that something that my son needs to do? Are there different ways to play football, especially at that young of an age? Because Doc's concussion started pretty young. He writes about back in sixth grade having this like severe migraine from what he thought was a concussion in the football game. That's really scary. That's terrifying.
Well, you talk a lot about Dr. Omalu, and he spoke in Tulsa a couple of years ago, but you know, his story, of course, as you mentioned, made famous in the where Will Smith played him. But he was, you know, the NFL really tried to discredit him and really was in denial mode, like you say, almost akin to the tobacco stories. But they haven't exactly, I guess, embraced him, but they've had to sort of deal with the issue. And so they now have concussion protocols, for one thing. They have a lot of advising committees for the league. They recommend that players who get their bell rung, so to speak, come out for a certain period of time. What about other levels? I mean, what is the NCAA doing, or what are high schools doing with regard to head trauma in football? Because it's, you know, there's not as centralized. I mean, the NCAA is national, so it is sort of a centralized. But there are many divisions of college football. High school, you know, it's 50 different states and different counties and different athletic administrations. I mean, so what are you seeing on those levels?
You know, it honestly depends on the state, but I would say with football across the board, from youth football, from Pop Warner, all the way up to the NFL, changes have been made, very big changes. Like, if you look at when Omalu was first coming out with his research, that was when, you know, mid to late 2000s, whatever you refer to, like 2005 to 2010 or so. And the NFL was very much in like this age of denialism where they just denied the research and discredited the researcher. That is not, and like that, I do think, especially with football, there's a trickle down effect where the NFL has so much money and so much power that what the NFL does helps set the tone for the rest of it. The NFL is not in an age of denialism anymore. I wrote in this book about going to a head trauma conference at University of North Carolina, and there's all these neuroscientists and sports trainers there, people who are way smarter than I could ever imagine to be. And there was the NFL's top doctor, Dr. Alan Sills. And he started his presentation saying, CTE is real. This is a real thing. And basically saying, yes, football has played a part in this. And then he highlighted the many, many rule changes that the NFL has had, something like 46 rule changes over the past decade. Things like a lot of them have to do with kickoffs, because that is the most dangerous play, because you have two teams that are running full speed at each other. But the NFL has done, at the very least, a passable job at the quote-unquote unnecessary roughness part of things. You see that. I think, frankly, college football has done a better job with that, where if you get a targeting penalty, you're out of that game right away. There's not a question about it. I think in the NFL, it can still be like, should he get kicked out of the game? If you get a targeting penalty in college, boom, you're done. And you see that in younger leagues, too. I think people realize, one, this is a very real issue, especially for developing bodies and developing brains. But also, two, kind of the flip side of it, is this is an existential question for football. Football needs, as an institution, to get its arms around this concussion problem, this traumatic brain injury problem, this CTE problem. They need to get their arms around it, or I do think a generation or two from now, as the science catches up, if the NFL, college football, youth football, if they don't make very real progress in this, I think this sport could go the way of boxing, which is still around, but it's very much a niche sport, whereas a few generations ago, that was one of the most popular sports in America.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is journalist Reed Forgrave, who is the author of the new book, Love, Zach, Small Town Football and the Life and Death of an American Boy, and it's published by Algonquin. And we're talking about the subject of his book, Zach Easter, a young, you know, little league on up through high school football player in small town Iowa who had so many concussions, he wound up with chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Reed Forgrave, do all football players show some evidence of CTE? I mean, has there ever been a sort of a study to look at a random slice, a random sample of football players?
So there was one published in the New York Times that showed 110 out of 111 NFL brains showed signs of CTE. There have been plenty of people who have argued with that study. The science here really is so young. If you look at this coronavirus thing, we want the magic pill tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
And when I'm at this neurotrauma conference, the phrase that you'd hear from these doctors and researchers again and again was the infancy of the science. These things take time. I mean, getting a virus vaccine has taken more time than anyone wants, and that's when you have an entire world devoting its scientific resources toward it. When you talk to researchers, they think there's like a 30-year time horizon before they can figure this out. There's some really promising science out there. Things like using biomarkers in saliva or in blood that can say on the sideline, pretty close to immediately after a big hit, yes, you have a concussion, no, you don't have a concussion, instead of what we do now, which is a lot of guesswork. Doctors look at the eyes, they ask you questions, you go in that little medical tent, and they say, yeah, it looks like you probably have a concussion. You can't really tell. It's not like a broken bone. And I think that's the scary part for parents right now. Doc Easter's parents, in a way, they have this excuse, because in the early 2000s, when Zach was playing football, we didn't know about these connections between contact sports, especially ones with football, where it's so hard to take the head completely out of the game, and mild traumatic brain injuries, which is another word for concussions, and then the lifelong effects of it. We just didn't know. Now, if you're a parent, we know, but there isn't a magic pill. There's not a solution. We're still uncertain. We know that there is a correlation here, but we don't know how to solve it. And to a parent of two young boys, that's the scariest part.
Yeah. I'm curious, Reed, how did you come across the Easter family and how were you selected, in a sense, to tell Zach's story?
Yeah, as a long-form writer who often focuses on stories of people who've gone through suffering, I believe that there's a great meaning comes from people who go through suffering and come through the other side. I've spent a lot of my career searching for stories like this, and this one completely fell in my lap. I used to work for the Des Moines Register, which is the biggest newspaper in Iowa. I knew a lot of people in Iowa. I had just moved up to Minnesota, and someone passed on an obituary that ran in the newspaper I used to work for right before Christmas of 2015. It was Zach's obituary, and I remember reading it, and the final paragraph just stopped me in my tracks, because it spoke in just such a forthright way about Zach basically framing his suicide as a selfless act and wanting people to know that his last wish was to make sure no one else would suffer from the sort of head trauma that he did. And it detailed that Zach had he wanted to tell his story about CTE. So I was on the phone with Zach's mom, Brenda Easter. I think it was either the day before or the day after his funeral. I was sitting on their living room floor 2 weeks after his death, spent 4 hours talking with him. And I remember what struck me at that time. Number one was that his parents spoke about this journal that Zach left behind. And this wouldn't have been a book if it weren't for Zach's words. Zach's words are so powerful, they're poignant, they're thoughtful, and they're just very real of a man struggling with some very severe brain issues, and somehow being able to express it in words. It's a remarkable document. The second part of what struck me from the first time I met this family was the whole time that we're talking, guess what was on the television behind me? It was a Sunday afternoon in early January. It was the Vikings, Zach's favorite team. I'm sorry, his father's favorite team against the Packers, Zach's favorite team. And all the men in that room, including me, by the way, were sneaking glances at the game. It was a really good game. We're looking at our phones to check our fantasy football scores. Even as Zach's mother is saying, in no uncertain terms, football is a sport that killed my son. It really, to me, symbolized how America feels about this sport. We're in love with it. In some ways, we're addicted to it. We see a lot of the good in it. And now we definitely see a lot of that bad in it.
So Zach was very copious in his journaling and had some real wishes. And the family, in the wake of his death, what have they done to try to both tell his story, and you've been a big part of that, but also to assure that this doesn't happen to anybody else?
Yeah, his family has been remarkable. Especially his mother and his girlfriend. They're very driven to tell his story. His father, I think it's a little bit more complicated with his dad because he's tortured by this, and he's a man's man. He's not someone who's going to go to a therapist and talk it out. He was Zach's football coach from youth through high school, and he feels, I think, a deep sense of guilt in this. But what Zach's family has done, one, they've been very forthright in telling his story. And with mental illness and brain injuries, the amount of stigma and shame that can come with it, and with suicide, the stigma and shame is very real. I think it's courageous of them to be willing to share the pain that they will never get over as a family. As long as they live, they will never get over this. And yet they share it. I think there's lots of work in that. In a more tangible way, they started a nonprofit foundation in Zach's honor. It's called CTE Hope. If you Google CTE Hope or go to ctehope.com, it might be ctehope.org, one of those two, you can see about the research that they're helping to fund. I should point out, part of the proceeds from this book, I donated to this family foundation. And I mentioned that the potential of saliva-based biomarkers, sort of like the sideline saliva test that can say, hey, look, you have a concussion 5 minutes after you just got hit in the head. That is some research that this foundation has been heavily involved in the state of Iowa. It's, like I said, it's really promising research, although it might be really, really far away. This family has been incredible in dealing with this tragedy in the most forthright way that they can.
Well, it is nice to see their energy certainly used in a positive direction when something so tragic has befallen them. The name of the book is Love, Zach, Small Town Football and the Life and Death of an American Boy. And it's by our guest today, journalist Reed Forgrave, who is a long-form reporter at the Star Tribune of Minneapolis. Reed Forgrave, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely awesome to be on public radio. Thank you so much.
Reed Forgrave is a reporter with the Star Tribune of Minneapolis. His new book is called Love, Zach, Small Town Football and the Life and Death of an American Boy. It's published by Algonquin. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.